Before we go on to this afternoon's topic, is there anyone who has any questions from the discussion groups that they would like to bring up? Nothing? Yeah.
I want to know what exactly Buddha said.
What?
I want to know what exactly the Buddha said about life. Many old Buddhists quite mad.
About life?
Yes, about life. Many old Buddhists quite mad are very pessimistic. That's true. And then people say, and you said they misunderstood. But I think it's not only mere misunderstanding. Actually, Buddha emphasized life is suffering very much.
Right.
Okay. Then but some people, many old books, again, life is full of misery, full of suffering, full of sorrow. The only way to get true happiness is in Nirvana. But, you know, I have an opposite idea about life. I want to know what exactly Buddha said.
Yeah.
No Buddhism, only Buddha.
Yeah. Good. Good question. First is that when we talk about this topic, we're translating into English. So in the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha was using the word dukkha, and he was explaining unpleasant, pleasant, and this all-pervasive. So when we hear that the Buddha said all life is suffering, he didn't say all life is unpleasant, painful experiences. He said all life is dukkha. So we need to understand that. Yeah? Otherwise, of course, we come up with some strange ideas. And one thing that we're going to see very clearly as we go on is the Buddha taught according to people's capacity and what they needed to hear. So he taught many different things to many different people. And if you look at what he teaches in different places and you look at it literally, some of the things he said will seem to contradict each other. But they're not contradictory because they're speaking according to the capacity of the person who's listening. So one of the great challenges of looking at the teachings of the Buddha and also later masters is the art of hermeneutics, of interpretation, of understanding what he meant. Because if we literally accept everything he said, in fact, in one sutra he said, you should kill your father and your mother. But he was talking to a person about getting rid of the mental afflictions of attachment and aversion, and that's how the person could then understand that. So we need to be very careful in how we interpret. And of course, it's not easy to interpret different teachings that the Buddha gave. So this is one point we need to be aware of. And also, you said many people feel Buddhism is pessimistic. But actually, and we're talking about the First Noble Truth. The First Noble Truth, the diagnosis, can never be pessimistic. A diagnosis is either accurate or inaccurate. So either the First Noble Truth of dukkha is an accurate diagnosis of our condition or it's inaccurate. It can never be pessimistic or optimistic. It's either right or wrong, accurate or inaccurate. So when we say, you know, that people are pessimistic because the Buddha said all life is suffering, you can't be pessimistic because of that. Either you accept that or you don't accept that. What can be pessimistic is the prognosis. Can we do something about it? And the prognosis, if the prognosis is, oh, sorry, there's nothing to be done, that could be a pessimistic prognosis. Like often in many modern traditions and philosophies, from a Buddhist perspective, they would be pessimistic because a lot of, and we're going to see this a little bit this afternoon and tomorrow, There are a number of modern philosophies and traditions that say the basic the human nature of our mind is anger, is jealousy, is craving. That is the nature of our mind. You're stuck with it. At best, you can maybe reduce it a little bit, but to get rid of that, impossible. Because the basic human nature of the mind is craving, is anger, is jealousy. To say that, from a Buddhist perspective, that would be very pessimistic. Well, be inaccurate as well. But what's pessimistic is that we wouldn't be able to get rid of those mental afflictions. So we need to be also very careful about this first noble truth. Either what the Buddha was saying was right and accurate, or wrong and inaccurate. But it can never be pessimistic, the first noble truth. So that's something we also need to understand. So what we find as well is that that it's very difficult if we go directly to the teachings of the Buddha, the sutras, the various sutras, it's very difficult to get a very clear overall framework. Because again, the Buddha taught according to people's needs and capacities. So he taught this here, this here, this here. And so there are like hundreds of sutras. We wouldn't have the time to look at them anyway. And then we'd look at one and another and we'd say, well, that doesn't seem to fit together. Fortunately for us, a lot of the great Indian masters did the work for us. They did all this work and put together a very clear framework from all the various teachings that we can then look at and make understanding of. So what we find is, particularly in the Mahayana traditions, that when we are talking about a particular topic like nature of reality or compassion or so forth, rather than going directly into the Buddha's sutras, which is very difficult to do, we would rely on one of the great Indian masters who put all this stuff together for us in a very cohesive, clear way. And also, of course, within those teachings of the Indian masters, when they talk about a point, they say, I got this from this sutra in the Buddha here. But then they put it all together and make a clear presentation for us. So it's often much easier to understand what the Buddha was saying on a particular topic by going to these texts. So that's some things regarding your question. Okay?
The first question is that if we are today, Lord is concerned,
Yeah.
So we were wondering, on the one hand, you say we have to give up on the eight body concerns, so we want to be. On the other hand, you said that like, if we have a good meal, we still enjoy it. If we have a good meal,
yeah,
you'll still enjoy it.
Right.
So, what does it actually mean to give it up? Because, like, you want it, but not that much.
Just a little bit.
And if it's not enough.
Yeah. In fact, that's exactly the reason I asked this question. So that we get a clear understanding of what it means to give up the eight worldly concerns. That's why I asked the question. Because often people misunderstand what that means, to give up the eight worldly concerns. And often people feel, to be a good Buddhist, I have to give up my enjoyment of good meals. But this is a complete misunderstanding. So I briefly mentioned this morning, to give up, we're not giving up the eight worldly things. So we're not giving up pleasure, money, praise and good reputation. What we're giving up is an unhealthy attitude to those things. The attitude that says those things are going to give me happiness. In other words, to give up craving and attachment for them. So if we give up craving and attachment for these things, we can actually enjoy them much more than we do now.
So we should pursue them, but knowing that it won't make us happy?
Again, when you say pursue them, if we're pursuing them so in the hope that they're going to give us some lasting happiness, no. If we pursue them in terms of providing good conditions for us to be able to strive for genuine happiness? Yes. Because we need good conditions. We need healthy body. We need roof over our head. You know, we need all these things if we're going to pursue genuine happiness. Yeah, this is a topic that I'll be touching on tomorrow and also 2 days later again. Because this is a very important point, in that particularly when we hear about this equanimity, people feel like maybe the goal of the Buddhist path is that in the face of suffering we should just have a blank mind, we should be unmoved, we should just be there and no effect. This is pathological. This is not the goal of Buddhist practice. This is unhealthy. What we're talking about, and this is going to come more later, is that often when we're faced with suffering, we either get overwhelmed by it, or if we don't, we run away from it. So both of those ways of dealing, of course, are not helpful. So what we're talking about in equanimity is avoiding those two things. Equanimity is to remain calm and be fully present with the suffering and work with it as best we can. But we're going to talk more about that coming.
And also how you feel free from suffering, how you stay compassionate.
Yes. And we're going to talk about that as well. That's going to come up. That has a lot to do with this sort of empathy that we're, because we have experienced suffering, even though maybe now, let's say we've managed to get free of suffering, we know directly what that person is experiencing. And what we're going to see as well is that, and this comes up for the, what's your name from Korea? I forgot your name. Yeah. What she said in her introduction last night about being love, what we can understand, what we're going to see is that when we come to understand and realize the nature of reality and be in that state, that naturally expresses itself as love and compassion spontaneously. So this is what I think she was saying, is that that is the expression of reality. If we're in that state, we don't have to think about should we be compassionate or not. It will just spontaneously come. Of course, until we're at that point, we need to think about it and work on it and try to cultivate that. You know, we need to put effort in cultivating it. But when we get to that point, love and compassion is the natural expression of the nature of reality.
In the sense of, if I'm not attached to things, how can I choose the things that I will try to do?
Again, the choice will come in terms of what is beneficial and versus harmful in terms of striving for genuine happiness. And again, at a higher level, it becomes an automatic thing based on the nature of reality. But at our level, of course, and this is going to be something that I'm going to talk about later when we talk about the nature of reality, and I think this is what you're touching on when you talk about relativism, is that it's not like we just fabricate reality in whatever way we want. It's not, that is not the nature of reality according to Buddhism.
also define kind of ethics.
Yeah. And again, what we can understand, and this is going to come later as well, is at the deepest level, when we talk about ethics in Buddhism, it's a natural expression of the interconnected nature of reality. Any other questions from discussion group? Okay, let's move on to this afternoon's topic then. So, we're using the Four Noble Truths as the framework for all of our discussions. So the Four Noble Truths, of course, the very first teaching that the Buddha gave after achieving enlightenment. And as we saw this morning, the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha is being like our doctor, diagnosing what our current condition is. We're stuck in this state of dukkha. We're cycling in this state of dukkha, life after life. Why are we stuck in this state? What are the causes? We're going to look at in more detail, of course, tomorrow. But very briefly, we saw that why we're stuck in this state is because of our mental afflictions, particularly our attachment and aversion. And these are coming from our fundamental ignorance, our misunderstanding of the nature of reality. And that the Buddha's prognosis is that we can overcome this unsatisfactory state of dukkha because we can eliminate the mental afflictions. These are not part of the nature of our mind. In particular, we can eliminate this fundamental ignorance, misunderstanding nature of reality. We can eliminate that, thereby eliminating the mental afflictions and eliminating suffering, the state of dukkha. We can become liberated from all suffering and its causes. The third noble truth, truth of cessation, the ending of suffering. We can achieve the healthy state of nirvana. How do we do that? What's the medicine? What's the cure? The fourth noble truth, truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So this, of course, is all the practices that we need to engage in to achieve that state of nirvana. So what we saw this morning then is that we often feel as if the source of our suffering and the source of our happiness is out there in the world, and thereby our most common technique or a method to try to find happiness and overcome suffering is manipulating the things around us, attracting the things that seem to be the source of our happiness, trying to push away or avoid the things that seem to be the source of our suffering. So attachment and aversion. But what we saw there was that rather than actually helping us to achieve happiness and overcoming suffering, attachment and aversion, all that they do is it magnifies the amount of suffering we experience. And so what the Buddha discovered, and of course many Buddhist contemplatives have discovered over the centuries, is that actually the source of suffering and happiness is within our own mind. Particularly the source of suffering is these mental afflictions. And so we need to transform our mind, we need to eliminate these mental afflictions from our mind. So the core thing with all of these things in Buddhism, of course, is the mind itself. We're talking about working with the mind, transforming the mind. So, of course, then it would be helpful to understand what do we mean by the mind? What is the mind? Because we're focusing on that and working with that. So that's what I'd like to do this afternoon, is talk about the Buddhist theory of mind. Now, there are, of course, many theories of mind in the world today. And I want to, of course, talk about the Buddhist theory of mind, but I want to briefly talk about another theory of mind so we can compare them and see how they're similar and different. And so the other theory of mind I want to briefly introduce first is a theory of mind that is widely accepted within a branch of science called scientific materialism. So in scientific materialism, the general assertion is that everything in the known universe can be described in terms of matter and energy. And so in this theory, the theory of mind is basically that the mind can be explained in terms of matter and energy. In fact, the mind is really nothing more than the brain, the functioning of the brain, or sometimes what's called an emergent property of the brain. So I'd like to briefly introduce this theory of mind first, and then look at the implications of this theory, and then compare it to the Buddhist theory of mind. But before I do that, a little bit about terminology first. The cause of suffering, yes.
It comes from the mind?
Yeah.
Is that through the physical suffering?
We're going to see, what we need to understand is there's a difference between pain, which is sensation, and suffering. They're not the same thing. Like a classic example, let's say it's very hot. So you have a lot of sensations of heat on the body. And of course, if we're in very hot conditions outside, we go, oh, I'm suffering so much, it's so hot. But then we go into a sauna where it's probably double the heat, and we go, oh, that's so nice, so nice. So we have sensations on the skin, and on the hot day, we're interpreting those as suffering. In the sauna, we're interpreting those sensations, which are much more intense, as pleasurable. So we need to understand there's a difference between sensation and suffering. So we're not saying that if we become enlightened and we break our arm, we're not going to have any sensations in the arm. Of course we will. The question is, what do we do with those sensations? But I need to really talk a lot more, particularly about the nature of reality, to really answer that well. Okay.
If all suffering comes from mind, why Buddha didn't say life is full of love and joy and happiness?
You did.
Our mind makes dukkha.
He did. He does. Yeah, sure.
Said before,
sure.
Buddha said life is dukkha. It's very different.
Right, but I mean, also in different places he teaches different things. In some teachings, the mind is naturally pure. There, you have many wide range of teachings. A lot, in fact. Anyway, there's more to say on that, but it's going to come later, so we'll leave it till then. So, now, terminology here. We have a number of terms that are used very often in this context, and they are some of the most common terms you'll see is mind, consciousness, awareness. When we speak very generally, these three words mean the same thing. Mind equals consciousness equals awareness, generally. But then when we go into specific areas, they can take on a slightly different meaning, and we'll see some of those differences coming. And one thing I'd like to mention is this word awareness here can create a lot of confusion, because it's a very popular word, and unfortunately a number of translators use the same word to translate very different Sanskrit terms. And so then we see have a lot of confusion, because we think this is always meaning the same thing. So we have to be very careful when we see this word awareness, and we're going to see one case already this afternoon, in that sometimes this word awareness is used to describe the function of the mind. The function of the mind, of course, is to be aware. So often then the word awareness is used in terms of a verb, in terms of how the mind functions, to be aware. Sometimes, and we'll see this in the shamatha practice that you're doing with Renato in the morning, there are two tools we use in that shamatha practice. One, of course, is, and I'm going to talk about this in detail later, one tool we use is mindfulness. And mindfulness is simply our ability to hold the object, to be able to hold the object and not forget it. But then, of course, we need to monitor that. We need some quality control. Is the mindfulness still working? So we need to monitor that. So the second tool is called introspection. Normally translated as introspection, is quality control, monitoring. Are we still on the object, or are we becoming dull or distracted? So the most common way that's translated into English is introspection, sometimes translated as vigilance or alertness. Some translators translate that quality control as awareness. Very confusing. And then also, we saw this morning there are these four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And I briefly mentioned that these two schools, the Nyingma and Kagyu school, who practice this Dzogchen and Maha Mudra, in that approach, and we're going to touch a little bit on some of the elements of that already this afternoon, we can talk about levels of mind. And in those systems, the mind we have now, they use this word mind. And for them, when they use the word mind, it means conceptual mind. Our mind is conceptual. And when they use the word awareness, they're only talking about the deepest level of our mind, which is completely non-conceptual. So in those traditions, mind and awareness are completely mutually exclusive. They're not the same thing. Wait. So what I'm suggesting here is when we see this word awareness, we have to be very careful and try to understand, how is this person using this word awareness? Are they using it in a very general way, just to mean mind or consciousness, or are they using it in some other way? But here this afternoon, when I'm speaking, and I use the word awareness, consciousness and mind, they mean the same thing.
When you say mind is a conception, when you say conceptual, what do you mean, like intellectual or...?
Conceptual, well, that's going to come. I'll answer that in the presentation coming up very soon. Okay, so that's the background. So first I'd like to briefly introduce the scientific materialistic theory of mind. So I'm not suggesting all of science accepts this theory. So we're only talking about a particular branch of science, scientific materialism, which accepts that everything in the known universe can be explained in terms of matter and energy. So I'm going to give a brief description of the theory of mind according to scientific materialism. And to do that, I'm going to read a little bit from a book called Tibetan Buddhism from the Ground Up by Alan Wallace. Alan Wallace is an American Buddhist. He's been following Tibetan Buddhism for more than 40 years. He also has a PhD from Stanford University, and he has his own organization in America, in the US and California, called the Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies, where he works together with the scientific community very closely, particularly neuroscientists, and to try to come to a common understanding of mind. So I'm just going to read a little bit what he says about the scientific materialistic theory of mind. Contemporary scientific materialism asserts that objective reality is composed entirely of matter and energy, and that reality has been that way since the origin of the universe. In this scientific system, awareness, or mind or consciousness, is an emergent property of the nervous system, and the nervous system is composed entirely of matter and energy. Scientific materialism offers quite a plausible account of the evolution from unconscious atoms and energy to the emergence of the human mind. This theory states that some point early in the history of the cosmos, if we accept the Big Bang theory, atoms formed into molecules. These molecules had new properties. A molecule such as water, H2O, for instance, has qualities not found in either of its atomic components of hydrogen or oxygen, either individually or collectively. To take some of its obvious properties, water is wet at 70 degrees Fahrenheit and it freezes at 32 degrees, and salts will dissolve in it. These attributes, not found in the individual atoms of the water molecule, are therefore called emergent properties of these molecules. So what he's saying is that, as in the history of evolution, as atoms formed into molecules, the molecules have new properties. New properties emerged. So hydrogen and oxygen coming together, forming water. We have the emerging property of wetness and freezing and so forth, that are not present in the individual atoms. Okay. Organic molecules then combined to form single-celled organisms as well as viruses, which cannot be classified with certainty as either being living or non-living. In the former, life emerged as a property of the molecules that made up the cell. Eventually, the first cells with a neurosystem, such as Hydra, evolved. And from this point, we may speak of the emergent property of primitive awareness. Human consciousness, with all its complexity, the theory concludes, is merely an emergent property of a far more sophisticated configuration of matter and energy, the human body, which evolved according to the laws of natural science. So what he's saying is that as evolution continued and we started having organic molecules and then slowly life being formed, then eventually at some point where some primitive neurosystem evolved, from that point, due to the complexity, we can talk about the emergent property of awareness, mind or consciousness, that it's just an emergent property of that neurosystem. So therefore, this theory concludes that the human mind, consciousness or awareness, is simply an emergent property of the neurosystem, particularly, of course, the brain. So therefore, the mind can be explained completely in terms of brain and brain function. So what are some implications of this theory? So we'll go on a little bit here. Let us now return to the water molecule. If the configuration of its individual atoms is destroyed, the atoms separate, the unique properties of the water molecule do not go anywhere. They simply vanish, for the organization of matter and energy from which they arose is no longer present. This is equally true, according to scientific materialism, of the emergent property of awareness, human or otherwise. When the neurosystem ceases functioning, the materialists say, awareness disappears without a trace. The implications of this view concerning the nature of death are clear. Individual awareness vanishes, and only a decomposing configuration of matter and energy remain. So some implications, of course, of this theory is that since the mind or awareness is an emergent property of the brain, then when the brain began to function at the beginning of this life, the mind comes into existence. And at the end of this life, when the brain and neurosystem ceases functioning, the mind disappears without a trace. So these are the implications of this theory of mind. So that's very simply the scientific materialistic theory of mind. So therefore, in this theory, when we talk about the mind, particularly if we're talking about thoughts and emotions and so forth, from that perspective, they are completely explained in terms of brain function. They are taught that thoughts and emotions are nothing more than electrical signals and chemical flow in the brain. That's it. Nothing more than that. That's the implication of this view. So let's now have a look at the Buddhist theory of mind and how that compares. And we can begin with a simple definition of mind in Buddhism. So a very simple definition of mind in Buddhism is that the mind is that which is clear and knowing, or sometimes translated as the mind having clarity and awareness. In these two word definitions, the first word is describing the entity of the thing. The second word is describing the function. What does this thing do? For example, the simple definition of fire is that fire is hot and burning. So what is the entity of fire? Is heat. What does fire do? It burns. So what is the entity of the mind? Is that the mind is clear or has clarity. What does the mind do? The mind knows, it is aware. So here we see that the word awareness is used in terms of the function of the mind, that the mind, how the mind functions. So let's now have a little bit more detailed look at what do we mean by that the entity of the mind, the mind is clear or has clarity. So this word clear or clarity implies two things. One, the word clear or clarity implies that the mind is not physical. So the Buddhist theory of mind is that the mind is not the brain, it's not a function of the brain, it's not a property of the brain. That in Buddhism there are two types of phenomena in the world. There are physical things, which are made up of matter and energy, and then there are non-physical things, or mental things, the mind. So there are two classes of phenomena. There's not just matter and energy. So that's the first understanding or implication of the word clear or clarity. The mind is not physical, it's not the brain. Also, the word clear or clarity here implies that the mind is clear or having clarity means that because of that, the mind enables things to appear in it. For example, because a mirror is clear, reflections can appear in the mirror. Because the mind is clear, thoughts, emotions, memories, and so forth can appear in the mind. And then what does the mind do? What's its function? Is that the mind knows, the mind is aware, the mind engages in appearances. So that is the simple functioning of the mind. So that is a very simple definition of the mind. What I'd like to do now is give three presentations of mind from different perspectives to try to understand this in more detail. But any questions about this definition?
Yeah, just to understand, to make sure I understood. So when you say mind equals clear knowing, this is the Buddhist
theory of mind.
And like the natural place of the mind, not today.
What, sorry? Not the natural.
Not, I don't know if natural, but today with the conditioning and all that, you kind of everything, so our mind is not clear, completely annoying. I'm asking, or.
Right, so.
According to the.
Okay, so the analogy here is a glass window is clear by nature. But that doesn't mean it doesn't have dirt on it.
Okay, that's why I said innate, natural.
Yeah. So the mind being clear of clarity.
That's how it's supposed to be, and after.
That's its nature. But of course, like a window can have a lot of dirt on it, our mind can have a lot of dirt. So now when we look at a dirty window, we can't see its clear nature. When we look at our mind now, we don't see much clarity. All we see is mental afflictions. Remember, this is only an analogy, it's not an example.
But I'm trying to understand how it's not part of the nature of the mind, with mental affliction, supposedly, like.
Well, of course, this is the Buddhist assertion. I mean, we shouldn't accept that just because the Buddha said so. What we need to do is investigate ourselves. That's how we're going to know. Is my anger and jealousy part of the nature of my mind and I'm stuck with it, or can I do something to eliminate them? We can check that out ourselves. And until we do, this is just another theory. Yeah. So, very good point is often when we speak, we talk about mind in general. We often talk about thinking, and somehow emotions is something else. But here, of course, mind is all mental activity. It covers thinking, emotions, memories, mental images. All of that is within mind. Some of the what, sorry?
Some of the world is a physical.
Physical, yes.
And the mind, so the mind is the only thing that is not physical in the world, according to you?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Do animals have also a mind?
Yes.
All the animals?
Yes. It's fairly what, sorry?
Uncontroversial. The mind is not synonymous with the brain. It's the same, they have no relation, and the mind has no basis in matter whatsoever.
Did I say that?
Yes.
I did?
I think you said it's not. The mind is purely.
I said it's not physical.
It's not physical, okay.
I didn't say it's not related. In fact, the mind and the brain have a very close relationship. Very close relationship. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that in the presentation coming. So they're not separate.
So
you can't have a brain, a functioning brain, and a mind separately.
Which is why my mind is different to your mind. My anger and jealousy and fear is not the same as yours.
Correct. What we're saying here is that you can't subsume the two into one. But you can't say that's mind and that's operating separately from the brain. No. I want to talk about that later in terms of nature of reality, but I usually in these courses I try to avoid using words like soul, ego and so forth, mainly because I think there are many different ideas about what they are. So if I start using the word soul and ego, maybe there's six different ideas in this room thinking what I'm talking about. But what I'm going to do is, when I talk about the nature of reality, I'm going to present some Buddhist ideas, and then we can see whether or not our personal idea of soul fits with that or not. Similarly, our personal idea of what we think ego is, does that fit or not? So that's going to come later. Sorry? You won't see the word soul. What we will see, and I'm going to talk about this in detail later, coming from the Sanskrit, there's a Sanskrit word called Atman, which usually is translated as self. And we're going to look at some qualities of this Atman, and then we can see whether or not that fits with our idea of soul, if we can use the same word soul to refer to that or not. But that's coming later. I didn't hear what you said, sorry, the rain.
Can you say again what the meaning of entity?
Entity. Entity just means the sort of basic nature of something. Like the example I gave was fire. The entity of fire, the basic nature of fire is heat. It's hot. Yeah, that's just the basic nature of that thing.
Essence?
Yeah, essence. You can use the word essence. Yeah, very good word. Essence.
You might be going on to this, but the scientific materialism, if you're saying that when hydrogen and oxygen form water, and then destroy hydrogen or destroy oxygen,
well, when the water molecule breaks apart, the property of wetness doesn't go anywhere, it just vanishes. So when the implication then is, when the nervous system stops functioning at the end of the life, mind doesn't go anywhere, it just vanishes.
Yeah.
Because it's just a property of the nervous system.
Okay, so I'm not...
No. I still haven't got to that yet. We haven't got that far yet. Yeah? Okay, what I'd like to do now is sort of talk a little bit more about the Buddhist theory of mind. And of course, this is one of the central key elements in all of Buddhism. And so we can look at the mind and look and focus on the mind from many different perspectives. So I want to introduce three perspectives now, briefly, to see if we can get a better understanding of what is this Buddhist theory of mind. What is the mind? And the first way we can look at the mind is in terms of the different types of objects we can experience with our mind. So, of course, we can experience the sense objects. We can experience visual objects, sounds, smells, taste, tactile sensations. So, therefore, we can... And then, of course, we can experience mental objects. We can experience thoughts and emotions. So we can experience six types of objects. And so because we can experience six types of objects, we can talk about six types of consciousness. We can talk about the five sense consciousnesses and the mental consciousness. So here, of course, we can talk about the visual consciousness. The visual consciousness experiences visual objects. The auditory consciousness experiences sounds and so on. The mental consciousness experiences mental objects, i.e. thoughts, emotions, memories, and so forth. Of course, we're not talking about six separate minds here. We're talking about six aspects of one mind. We only have one mind. But we can talk about that one mind from these six aspects, because we can experience six types of objects. Now, these sense consciousnesses are non-conceptual. Meaning, they contact their object directly in a non-conceptual way. So the visual consciousness sees colours and shapes directly, non-conceptually. Then, of course, what happens is we see, with our visual consciousness, we see this bowl. But then the mental consciousness interprets that data and goes, ah, I know what that is, that's a bowl. So the mental consciousness is engaging in that through a concept, the concept of bowl. So the mental consciousness is conceptual. But our mental consciousness understands and engages with things through concepts. So that's the first presentation, very briefly. Any questions on that? Mind. Same. But here, of course, we're talking about the six consciousnesses, which are six aspects of the mind. So we're not talking about six separate minds. Any other questions? Okay. Yeah. Again, they're not separate. They're only describing. Sorry? All of these have the same nature. We're talking about experiencing six types of objects. When we experience a visual object, we call our mind visual consciousness. When we experience a thought, we call that same mind mental consciousness. It's not, they're not like, we don't have a mind and we go, oh, that part is the visual, there's the mental. It's not like that. Depending on what we engage in, that it's one mind. When that mind is engaging in a visual object, that mind is called visual consciousness. When we're engaging in a thought, it's called mental consciousness. That's all. It's a way of understanding how we engage in different types of objects. That's all. So they're not separate things. So the question is, do these sense consciousnesses relate to things outside in the world? I mean, even from a neuroscientific point of view, is there any colour out there? Even according to neuroscience? There's not like a red colour there that we're contacting. No neuroscientist would accept that. Sorry? Now, I don't know if in neuroscience they really use a distinction here in conceptual and non-conceptual in this way. I'm not sure. I haven't really studied so much neuroscience. But because this in Buddhism, this distinction is very important for a number of reasons. And we'll be talking a little bit more about this later to distinguish this way of knowing the differences. And maybe in neuroscience there's not really that distinction or importance in distinguishing that.
Where is the conscious mind from?
That's going to come in the third presentation. So the question is about subconscious. Where does that fit in this? I'm going to talk about that in the third presentation. We're going to talk about the implications of the Buddhist theory of mind shortly, and then we're going to look at that in more detail tomorrow the next day. Right. So remember, this consciousness is a mind, is related to the brain. So if the brain is not functioning, these don't operate. Yeah? So when we're... Even a newborn baby has very primitive concepts. Of course, we develop our concepts through our life and make them more meaningful and better. I mean, even a dog has very basic concepts, you know, food, danger, and so forth.
So you said that five senses are not perceptual, by saying that the bowl is something that we're taught, that's a concept. But
correct.
Then these senses, there are things that different cultures have, they decipher things in a different way. So
yeah, you what, sorry?
They decipher things in different ways, so they'll see red, and some people will see four different reds, and so...
That's this. So this is cultural conditioning here. Through cultural conditioning, how we interpret data will be completely different through cultural conditioning. So, you know, like I think the Eskimos have 20 words for snow because in that culture it's useful to develop those concepts for the survival. But that's cultural conditioning, that's here. Okay. Let's move on to the second topic. We can also look at the mind in terms of functioning. How does the mind function in every experience? And here, we can divide the mind into two. And we can talk about main mind and mental factors. So main mind is simply the part of the mind that contacts the object, the raw object. And then mental factors are the various aspects of the mind that determine what type of experience we have of that object. So of course, the mental factors, we're talking really about Buddhist psychology. And so here in Buddhist psychology, when we talk about mental factors, usually we come up with a list of 51 mental factors. And these mental factors, again, determine what type of experience we have of the object. 26 of the 51 mental factors are mental afflictions. So it seems like very often in our experience of things, we have a lot of mental afflictions involved. So of course these are things like anger, craving, jealousy, anxiety, depression. All of these are mental afflictions. But of course also in this list we have positive qualities, love, compassion and so forth. And then I'll just mention two or three other mental factors that are very important that we're going to be looking at in more detail in the coming days. course, one mental factor, very important, is mindfulness, our ability to focus on the object without becoming distracted. So, very important mental factor. This is the one we are trying to strengthen and cultivate in the shamatha practice that you're doing with Renato each morning. We're trying to improve that and strengthen that. There is another mental factor that's very important that we're going to be starting to touch on tomorrow, and that is the mental factor of feeling. So here again, we have to be careful with terminology. Normally when we speak very generally, when we use the word feeling, often we mean emotion. In Buddhism, when you see the word feeling, it does not mean emotion. Feeling is a mental factor of experiencing the object as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's coming from the Sanskrit word vedana. So remember, we can experience mental objects and sensory objects. So when we experience sensory objects, this vedana is usually translated as sensation. We can experience pleasant, unpleasant sensations in the body. Mentally, we tend to translate that as feeling. We have pleasant, unpleasant, neutral mental experiences. The reason, of course, that this gets a lot of attention in Buddhism is that this is where we start to get problems. Because it's on the basis of pleasant and unpleasant feelings and sensations that we often develop attachment and aversion, and then the whole mess starts. So therefore, this feeling gets a lot of spotlight in Buddhism, that we need to pay attention to these. We need to pay attention particularly to our pleasant and unpleasant feeling sensations and not react to them. So we're going to talk more about that in the coming days. And then, of course, other mental factors include wisdom, which we need to develop, and so on and so on. This topic, again, Buddhist psychology, it's a whole subject matter itself. In Tibetan Buddhism, it's called Lo-Rig, minds and awarenesses. And it can really help us to understand how our mind functions in all of our experiences. In particular, how our mind is dysfunctional, how our mind is reacting in not a very good way to the things we experience. So this is a very good presentation to really understand the workings of our mind. Any questions about this? So, in this list of 51, some of them are always present in every experience. This mental factor is always present in every single experience. But we don't have anger in every single present experience. So often, these mental afflictions are dormant. They're not active.
Potential.
Yeah, potential. We have habit, potential, seed. We can disposition, predisposition. We can use all of those words. So many of these mental afflictions, of course, are sometimes there, sometimes not. But things like feeling, and there's a few other mental factors, are present in every single experience. Any other questions about this? Right. So the main mind is simply, remember this is in terms of how our mind functions in our experiences. So the main mind is the aspect of the mind which simply contacts the raw object itself. And these mental factors fill in the type of experience we have of that object. So of course we can't have these two things separately. They always come together. But using an analogy for this, sometimes people use the analogy that the main mind is like drawing the outline of a drawing, and then the mental factors is filling in all the detail. A little bit like that. So they always come together, of course. You can't have main mind there, mental factors there. They're always together. Both of these are here and here. It's a different way of dividing up. So when we... Well, when our visual consciousness looks here, the main mind simply contacts colour and shape. Mental factor might be that we have a pleasant experience. We have no mindfulness, so we're contacting the object, but it's not registering. We may have some anger arising in that experience. We may get irritated by looking at that.
Yeah, like the way I understand it, it kind of sounds like the main mind is all sensory input, and then the factor is how we respond to that. Like, it's, we all drop that main mind and take the mental factor, the five sensory consciousnesses, and use them as like one information.
Yeah. So, of course, here we can talk about how we initially experience the object. But of course, we can also then talk about then on that basis how we react. So that's, of course, another mind. And how we react has main mind and mental factors. So each moment has both of these present. Every moment of our experiences.
Capacity to experience some incredible amount of things per second.
Right.
And discerning, the capacity to discern what, how we've reacted to is obviously what the Buddha's done in terms of the development of mind, the development of the mindfulness, which
yes.
gives that clarity sure. as to what we're
doing. Sure. Yeah. So on that question, a couple of things that are interesting. So the question is that we can perceive many different things in a very short time, like a second, and that in Buddhism we are developing our capacity to work with those instead of react to them. So a couple of interesting points there is that the mind, and this is actually going to come up next, but we'll bring it in now, is the mind is not a thing that moves through time. You know, like at the physical world level, if we look very superficially at the physical world, there appears to be objects moving through time. But is there really objects moving through time in the physical world if we look closely? No. If we really look very closely at the physical world, what's really happening is a flow of change, continuous flow of change. There's not a fixed, static thing moving through time. It seems like there is, but actually there's just a flow of change happening. And in that flow of change, we have to make sense of that, otherwise we couldn't function. So we create objects in that flow and interact with that because it's helpful. But if we understand these objects properly, they're just a flow of change. Likewise, the mind is not a single thing moving through time. It's a flow of change. And in that flow of change, we're having different experiences, one after the other. And we call that flow of change the mind, like it's useful to call in this flow of change here, it's useful to call this a mouse because it's meaningful. So it's useful to call this flow of mental experience the mind. It's useful. So therefore the mind is a continuum of experience unfolding. And in one very short moment, 1 second, we can experience many objects. And it seems like we can focus on two or more things simultaneously. Seems like. Technically, impossible. Technically, the mind in any moment can only have one object. What's happening is in a short time, even in 1 second, our mind is flipping backwards and forwards many times from what we see, what we're hearing, what we're thinking. So it seems like I can look at this, listen to the rain, and think about what I'm going to do later simultaneously. Technically impossible. But in that 1 second, I've moved backwards and forwards between these three objects maybe 50 times. When we're developing particularly mindfulness, we can, and we need a certain amount of time, minimum amount of time, for something to appear before it registers. You know, we need certain number of milliseconds of something appearing to the mind before it registers. You know, they used to do these subliminal things flashing up on the TV, and they wouldn't register the conscious mind, but maybe to the deeper level of mind. But what we find is that, and this has been studied scientifically, is meditators who improve their mindfulness can pick up objects in a much shorter time than a normal person. For us, maybe we need like 200 milliseconds of something appearing before it registers. But if we train mindfulness, maybe we can bring that 200 milliseconds down to 20 milliseconds. We can pick something up. So this is one of the things that training mindfulness can be helpful. Also, there, of course, are a lot of very subtle mental activity going on all the time. We don't notice that. And so, in fact, that brings me to the third presentation, so maybe I'll bring that in now to talk about this. And that is, we can talk about the mind in terms of levels. And in Buddhism, when we talk about different levels of the mind, we generally divide it into three levels: coarse, subtle, very subtle. And subtle and very subtle, of course, just means a deeper level of our mind. Coarse, subtle, very subtle. Because And the mind that's active now, the one we're using now, is the so-called coarse mind. Not very well trained, lots of distraction, dullness, lots of mental afflictions, not functioning very well. So what we're trying to do, of course, in meditation, is we're trying to refine that mind, particularly through that shamatha or stabilizing meditation. We're trying to work with the coarse mind. We're trying to make it more calm, more clear, more focused. So we're gaining access to a more subtle level of our mind through that shamatha practice. And the subtle and very subtle levels of the mind, in Buddhism, generally you only hear about that in the context of Vajrayana or Tantra practice, which we're going to talk about later in this course. Because for us now, to gain access to these levels of our mind, very difficult, almost impossible. So we can talk about So we can talk about these levels of mind. And we're here now in the course. Our mind is sort of up here somewhere, very coarse. Even within our coarse mind, the mind that we have active now, only a certain level of mental activity is obvious to us. Even at this coarse level of mind, at a deep, at a more subtle level, there's a lot of mental activity going on all the time. We don't notice it because our mind is not very well trained. So this is like our threshold. So I think in psychology, this is what we call here subconscious or unconscious. If we practice, particularly shamatha, if we improve our mindfulness, this threshold drops down. So what we're going to notice is as our mindfulness improves, we're going to start to pick up subtle mental activity that we don't notice now. Very helpful, because this subtle mental activity is the beginning of the coarse mental activity. And often what happens is, for example, when we get angry, there's often here, before we notice we're angry, there's already a lot of activity going on here. Some little bit of agitation, bit of tension happening. It doesn't register because our mind is not trained. And only when that surfaces here as anger, then we notice. But then often it's too late because already we're out of control with anger. We can't do much. So if we can start to pick up this subtle mental activity before it becomes coarse, we can do something about it. If we notice some irritation, a little bit of tension coming up, we go, oh, hang on, what's that? And then we're still in control, and then we can do something about it before it manifests as full-blown anger and we're completely out of control. So this is one method to help us to work with mental afflictions. Of course, there are many methods. This is one of them. So shamatha practice, which we're doing with Renato every morning, strengthening our mindfulness, is a very good basis for helping us to begin to work with our mental afflictions because of this phenomenon. Question?
If you practice the mindfulness meditation for a while and the psychology is going down and then you stop.
You stop?
Yeah.
Ah. Okay. If you go to the gym and get fit over 6 months and you stop going to the gym, what happens?
It's like a muscle in there.
Exactly. So if you stop, you don't immediately go back to before, but slowly then we go backwards. So if we put a lot of effort into this and we reach some level and then we completely stop, then slowly over time, yeah. Sometimes people use the word it's like a muscle that we have to develop. So this subtle and very subtle, and I'm going to talk about this in more detail in a couple of days when we talk about Tantra or Vajrayana. Because in Tantra or Vajrayana practice, there are practices to help us to gain access to this. Very difficult, not easy. If we can gain access to this deepest level of our mind, it's very powerful, completely non-conceptual, and if we can harness this level of our mind and use that, we can accelerate our progress in the spiritual path. But it's only within Tantra or Vajrayana level practice that there are methods describing how we can gain access to that. And we'll talk a little bit about that. So in the normal level of practice, you won't hear anything about this. In our normal level of practice, there'll be no mention of these levels of the mind. Only in Tantra or Vajrayana do we really hear about these levels of mind.
What is enlightenment in terms of the
mind? I didn't hear, sorry.
What is enlightenment in terms of the mind?
Sorry, speak up. What is enlightenment?
In terms of the
Yeah. Again, generally, if we're not talking Tantra or Vajrayana, then we only talk about this level of mind, because that's all that seems to exist. And so we simply work with this, refining it through Samatha practice, then we apply that in Vipassana practice, eliminate the mental afflictions, we achieve enlightenment. All with this. But then if you go into Tantra Vajrayana, they say, I don't think you're going to really get to enlightenment if you just work here. You'll need to go here, this level. Yes. So we can work here and progress a long way on the spiritual path. And if we've done that, then to go into Tantra Vajrayana is easy, because we're already well advanced. Then it's really just automatic that we go into that level of practice anyway. So no problem. Yeah. So the question is about taking drugs, hallucinogenics, ayahuasca, you know, mescaline, all of these things. Generally, it's not recommended because two reasons. One, of course, often these drugs can have a negative impact on the body, particularly if you're taking them regularly. And two, any experience that we have, it's actually difficult to understand what that experience was, because there's no framework of reference. Similarly, in Buddhism, if we just meditate, we can also have similar experiences to taking ayahuasca, mescaline, and so forth, if we just meditate. But then, of course, what do we do with that? You know, is that experience a valid experience, or am I just hallucinating? How do we know? We don't. So therefore, in Buddhism, we need a framework of understanding for meditation practice, so that when we have some meditation experience, we will better understand how to interpret that experience, whether that's a valid experience and to pursue it, or whether we're just spacing out, hallucinating, and just let it go. So, therefore, a much more effective way would be to have that framework and use meditation. It's much more sustainable. And also, of course, taking hallucinogenics or drugs, we're always requiring some sort of stimulus to have an experience. So it's not stable anyway. So, of course, what often can happen is someone who's already taken some of this, it can be a gateway into a more valid approach, meaning that through that experience we can sort of understand that maybe reality is not really as it seems to us, but let's use an approach that's much more reliable and effective in pursuing that. Because of our mental afflictions. Our mental afflictions are trapping us here. That's why, even in the shamatha practice of doing mindfulness, when our mind becomes a bit quiet and the mental afflictions are not very active, we can temporarily go down quite a lot. But it's only because of our mindfulness, our shamatha practice, that temporarily the mental afflictions are a little bit dormant. When we get out of that meditation, mental afflictions back and we start back up the air again.
In the natural meditation, I mean, like, you know, in this evolutionary perspective, if you think at this natural selection, I cannot imagine that you couldn't have selected, you know, through millions of years
There's a very interesting article about
this. Is this kind of proof that natural?
No, because these things are not part of the drive of natural selection. And there's a very interesting article about this, actually, that I'll share, I'll give available to everyone at the end of this course, by a cognitive scientist. Generally, I think many cognitive scientists follow the materialistic approach. But this guy, American, I think, he's very much challenging that. And part of his paper that he wrote is this about natural selection and what are the driving factors for natural selection. It's a very interesting article. Well, I think on that note, we'll finish up because it's time to finish. There's something more I wanted to add to this, but I think actually it's better I do that tomorrow morning as part of the review. So we'll do that tomorrow morning. So tomorrow's topics, if you want to prepare a little bit reading from your book, we're going to go on to the start to talk about the second noble truth, the truth of cause or origin of dukkha or suffering. So that's going to be on page 4, 5, 6 and 7. So page 4 to 7 is the material for tomorrow. And also the extra piece of paper you got, we're going to be looking at the suffering and its causes chart. So if you want to have a look at that before the class as well, it may be helpful. Then one last thing is, if there's anyone who would like to ask me a question but prefer to do that in private, maybe they have an important question that they want to discuss in private, then there's an opportunity to see me privately, a little 15-minute interview. So they will start tomorrow after lunch from 12:45 to 2. So there'll be 15-minute slots. So if you want to see me privately to ask me some sort of a question, and of course this is not just for a little casual chat, it's if you actually have something important that you would like to discuss with me privately, then please sign up on this sheet. I'll leave it on the table here. And then 5 minutes before your time, you need to come into the back of the building up to the first floor. And then there's one hallway here, but there's another hallway here. And right about here, there'll be a chair in the hallway. So just sit there, and I'll come and get you. So again, if you want to see me privately, sign-up sheet starting tomorrow. There's three or four slots every day after lunch. But again, only if you've got something important that you want to discuss with me. So I'll leave that on the table here. And now it's time for a break. So this afternoon and evening, of course, meditation with Renato, more analytical, investigative meditations. So this afternoon's meditation, you're going to explore a little bit what we looked at this afternoon, the mind, the nature of the mind. So try to really experientially come to see a little bit about your own mind. And then this evening, he's going to talk and meditate a little bit about, this idea we had this morning, this idea about pleasure versus genuine happiness, to try to really see a little bit experientially what we mean by that. So that's the topic for this evening. So let's have a break now and come back 5:30, and then, of course, I'll see you tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock.